Hello. Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here's Bob.
We're in a section of Ezekiel that deals with Tyre. Chapters 26 through 28 form a literary unit. It's paralleled in Isaiah 23 and Jeremiah 47:4, a condemnation against the Phoenician cities of both Tyre and Sidon. Now, we must remember that in this same literary context is the often disputed example about the king of Tyre moving over into the realm of the description of the evil one, much like Isaiah 14, and we'll be getting into that. This whole section deals with what used to be a friend of Israel during Solomon's days, Hiram, king of Tyre, but came to be a real problem during Ahaz's day when Jezebel brought the Phoenician fertility god Baal, and the chief deity is Melkart, into the northern 10 tribes. So here we have the continuing tension that grew up between the Phoenician city-states, which were primarily maritime trading centers, and the southern Judean state, which taxed caravans that came through. And so we have a commercial rivalry that began. This is some strong terms in denunciation, the strongest and the most prolonged treatment of this area anywhere in the Old Testament. This began in 26. Now it came about in the 11th year, on the first of the month, the word of the Lord came to me saying, it's the 11th year of the exile of King Jehoiachin, who is the official divinic line, but was deposed by Nebuchadnezzar II. Son of man, because Tyre has said concerning Jerusalem, ah, the gateway of the peoples is broken. This seems to be that Jerusalem was on a major interconnect between Egypt and the Fertile Crescent, and all those caravans going through Judah had to pay taxation. And so Tyre was saying, aha, another middleman is reduced. Well, it's the wrong one to laugh at. Look what God's going to do, verse 3. Thus says the Lord God, behold, I'm against you, O Tyre, and I will bring up many nations against you as the sea brings up waves. Now, this metaphor, the sea brings up waves, because Tyre was an island. It's about a quarter of a mile off the shore. Now, the city was on the mainland because the island wouldn't hold it all. It was an impenetrable fortress. It did not fall to very few people in its history. It became the maritime empire of the Phoenician city-states. And it was a tremendously wealthy place. Now, and they will destroy the walls of Tyre and break down her towers, and I will scrape her debris from her and make her a bare rock. There's the idea of the island. We know from later history the only thing she's used for is the drying of fishing nets, which is mentioned down here in verse 14. Okay? Now, and she'll be placed for the spreading of nets, verse 5, in the midst of the sea. I have spoken, declares the Lord God, and she'll become a spoil for the nations. Also her daughters who are on the mainland. Now, all the city couldn't fit on this small rocky island, so the rest of the city was kind of around the harbor. This is the only probably natural harbor on the Palestinian coast, except probably for Haifa. The rest is just straight coastline. Even the Romans had to build them a harbor at Caesarea, but this was a natural harbor. Okay? Verse 7, for thus says the Lord God, behold, I will bring upon Tyre from the north. Now remember, this was the invasion route. If you notice the map, all of the armies came from the north because of the desert that was directed to the east. So the normal invasion route was from the north, and that's where these armies are going to come. Now it says Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon. This is Nebuchadnezzar II. It's spelled different here. An N replaces the usual R. Now, Nebuchadnezzar's name, I'm not real good in Babylonian, but it's Nabu Keduri User, which means Nabu, protect my boundaries, or Nebo, protect my gains, one of the two of those. And so this spelling reflects the more Babylonian way of writing it, but it's spelled all with the R most places. Notice he's called King of Kings. Now, that's a tremendous title. It's used in Messiah. Here's a couple of references where it's used. Let's look first at Isaiah 10:8, Jeremiah 52:32, Daniel 2:37 and 47, and Ezra 7:12 is some of the places King of Kings is used. And of course, we can go to the book of Revelation for many more. That's going to be used at the end time. Notice they're going to come with horses, chariots, cavalry, and a great army. A lot of the army was a mercenary army, but the power and might of the current dominating power of the Fertile Crescent was Babylon. It's going to bring all her might against this small city, very powerful, wealthy city, but still a very small city. Now, notice where it says, he will slay your daughters in the mainland with a sword. He'll make siege walls against you and cast up a mound against you and rise up large shield against you. Well, this is a little bit incorrect. You couldn't do this to an island. You had to get out there first, and they couldn't get there. So we're using traditional siege metaphors to describe a different way of doing this. Now, Nebuchadnezzar besieged this city for 13 years, and we never have a record of it falling. There's no record in the Babylonian Chronicles of it falling. And from Ezra 29:18, it seems like the prophet realized it never fell, at least to Nebuchadnezzar. It will fall to Alexander the Great in 332 B.C. as he built a causeway out of the debris from the mainland city, and he overtook the city. The Arabs later on will take the city again, but it wasn't taken many times. Those two are all the ones I know. Now, this raise a large shield against you. This is a kind of a technique of the ancient military where they raised, put a shield up on top so the men on the walls couldn't throw rocks down those trying to knock a hole in the wall. That's what it is there. Now, notice it mentions your strong pillars in verse 11. Many think this refers to the gold and emerald statues in the city of Tyre dedicated to the god Melkart. And maybe that's it. We learned that from Herodotus. Whether it is or not, we're just not sure. Let's see. Notice they're going to sit on the ground in verse 16, verse 17. They're going to have a funeral dirge over this city that shows it's going to be, its power is going to be broken. A 13-year siege broke its power. Whether they ever got into the citadel, I'm not sure, but they broke the power of this city. Notice it says in verse 19, the deep over you, the waters are going to be there. And then again in verse 20, the pit. Now, the idea of the deep here is possibly the idea of the chaos of Genesis 1. Which may be a synonym for Sheol. Now, the pit are the lower parts of the earth in verse 20, but I shall set glory in the land of the living. Here's that paradox. He's going to bring them down to the pit, but he's going to restore, apparently, Israel to the land of the living. So here we have the idea of Sheol as the holding place of the dead. Both the wicked and the righteous go to Sheol. I've done a tape called Sheol, Hades, Gehenna, and Tartarus, which deal with all the major words in the Bible, New Testament and Old Testament, for the holding place of the dead of the afterlife. I hope you'll send for our free catalog for that tape. I wish I had time to go into it. Now, in chapter 27, I've called it the flagship Tyre of the fleet of materialism, and that's what she is. She is depicted as a marvelous ship with the most expensive rigging, the most expensive planking, the most expensive design of her day, and yet, because of her arrogance, she'll be destroyed. Notice it says in verse 3, I am perfect in beauty. Now, that's going to be what's picked up in chapter 28, to condemn this king as a representative of this people for their arrogance. And because we know from the book of Daniel that behind every nation there is a supernatural power, an angelic being in the book of Daniel, here we have an idea, I think, of Satan is behind the arrogance here. In verse 5, we have a little word S-E-N-I-R. This is an Aramaic way of speaking of Mount Hermon. You can read through here. It's just a description of the ship. This is one of the most complete documents, this chapter, that we have on all the ports in the Mediterranean world and what products they were famous for. Ezekiel must have been well acquainted with the caravans and travelers of his day to have this kind of detailed list of these faraway ports and their noted products of commerce, and so it's amazing. Mentions purple here in verse 7. That comes from a mollusk that was very common in that part of the Mediterranean where Tyre and Sidon are located, and that seems to be the allusion here. In verse 9, G-E-B-A-L is the modern Byblos. Many of these geographical names we're uncertain about. We're just not sure. Some we are. Lydia seems to be mentioned here in verse 10 as Lud. This is the first mention of Persia we have. Put seems to be the Septuagint calls it the Libyans, but it seems to be mentioned in Genesis chapter 10, which is a good background of this for geography. 10:6, it seems to be on the African coast, the Red Sea. We'd put modern Ethiopia probably. They hung huge shields around it. That was a way of decorating these ships or towers, was these war shields. That's what's allusion to here. Notice it mentions Tarshish in verse 12. Now, that may be the smeltering area of Spain. Some think it's the island of Sardis. Others think it's just legendary for the end of the earth. Probably, Sardis or Spain is probably best. We've mentioned several places here. Javan, which seems to be Greece. But there's another Javan listed down in verse 19, which is different. We don't know where it is. Tubal and Meshech are used in Ezekiel 38 and 39 for the tribes of the north that will later try to invade the land of promise. Notice they were involved in slave trading in verse 13. Y'all see Joel 3, 4 through 8, Amos 1, 9 and 10. We have Syria mentioned in verse 16, but the Septuagint and the Peshitta have the word Edom, and it seems to fit better than historically of what's discussed here. Notice the Arabian tribes of 20, 21, and 22. And notice verse 30 and 31 and 32, a series of things that were known for laments, like covering the head with dust, shaving the beard, dressing in sackcloth. It's going to be a funeral lament over this city. Now we come to 28, which is the heart of this lesson, which primarily gives us the background of why God's judgment fell on this city. It was basically pride was the problem, a pride that elevated itself to deity. Now, we know that the Tyranian king at this time was Ithbaal II. Now, of course, you see the term Baal there. These rulers were worshipped as gods, just like the pharaohs of Egypt. He was almost personified for his arrogance. Look where it says in verse 2, I am a god, repeated in verse 6, repeated in verse 9. It's just amazing what this ruler had said about himself or thought in his heart because of his prosperity and economic gain. There's certainly a word there for us. There's been much discussion here about, is this relating to Satan or simply a leader? Well, I think a good parallel is Isaiah 14, which deals with Babylon and military power. This deals with Tyre and economic power. And both of them are caught up in the world system that's against biblical faith. Now, I want to say to you that I think there's supernatural powers behind governments as well as individuals. We're either for or with God, or we're manipulated by the evil one and his. Now, I think in verses 1 through 10, some have said this is an allusion to the Antichrist, because in verse 2 it talks about taking his seat with the gods, and that seems very close to 2 Thessalonians 2:4. But really, because of verse 2, verse 8, and verse 9, it seems we're referring to simply the leader of the king of this Phoenician city-state. But in verses 12 and following, I think it is definitely Satan because of the tremendous things that are said about him that go far beyond the ability of a human being. And so here we have a human leader, prideful, arrogant, flowing into the chief enemy of God, who was prideful and arrogant. And I want to tell you, that is the problem of man. It's the pride and arrogance of man. That's what caused Adam and Eve to fall. Satan said, you want to be like God? And they said, well, that sounds good. And so notice here where it says, because your heart is lifted up and you have said, I'm a God. Now, I'm going to give you a few references where others have said that. The king of Babylon in Isaiah 14, 13. That's what happened to Adam and Eve, Genesis 3, 5. That's exactly what's going to happen to us if we're not careful. 1 Timothy 3, 6. Pride is the major problem of man. It is wanting to take the place of God. It is wanting to focus all of life around me and mine, what I want, what I desire. And, of course, Christian faith is quite the opposite. It's a laying down of our life and a focusing in on God's will. And that's what we have. Notice where it says, in the heart of the sea. And there, of course, is that allusion again to the island. You might see 24:4 and verse 8. It was on an almost impregnable island. And by the way, this island was called the Holy Island, if you can believe that by some. So it's a real sign of arrogance here. And yet you are a man and not God. Now, that's repeated in verse 4, verse 8, and verse 9. That's why I think the first few verses, 1 through 10, are referring to the historical leader of Tyre. And the reason it's so difficult to do this is because it's almost like it's intermingled between supernatural and natural man here. And it's hard to pull it apart. Verse 3 says, behold, you are wiser than Daniel. Now, Daniel was mentioned in chapter 14, 14, and 20. But there's been a real question if it's the Daniel that we know of in the Bible or the famous Daniel of the Rosh Shamrah text who is known for his wisdom. This Daniel is spelled differently from the Daniel of the Bible. Now, we know that he's mentioned with Noah and other ancient people in the faraway past. Now, Daniel was contemporary with Ezekiel. They are both in Babylon, Daniel in the capital and Ezekiel out by the river Kibar. So I really don't know if it's Daniel, as far as we know, or if it's this ancient mythological person like Solomon, known for his great wisdom. I'm just not sure. Because of the spelling and because of the date, I just can't be sure. Now, notice there is no secret that is a match for you. Well, that sounds like that supernatural element again, doesn't it? It's mixed all the way through here. It's why commentators have so pulled their hair out over it. And then in 4 and following are the problems that encountered this king that he couldn't handle. Number 1, wisdom that led to pride. Number 2, power and wealth that led to pride. Number 3, in verse 17, mentioned in chapter 27, verses 4 and 11, beauty, great beauty. And so this leader had wisdom, power, and beauty. And that's exactly what caused him to fall. Exact same thing that caused the evil one to fall. Let's see. Look at verse 7. The most ruthless of nations. Now, because of chapter 26, 7, which mentions Nebuchadnezzar II, this refers to Babylon. Babylon was a bloodthirsty, cruel nation. That's one reason Jews just couldn't believe God let that nation judge them, because they were so evil and so cruel. But God used them. Let me give you a few references for the evil of Babylon. Chapter 30, verse 11. Chapter 31, verse 12. Chapter 32, verse 12. They besieged this city in 585 through 573, but we don't think it ever fell. They just cut off its power by having their siege army there. Okay? Now, beginning verse 8, the pits mentioned again, which is Sheol. Now we'll see 26:20. And then God finally says, that settles it. I'm going to judge you, the last of verse 10. Now, beginning in 11 and following is what I think is a description of the evil one, and the reason that the tragedy of Satan or Lucifer is that he had so much, that he was given so much, that he had such great access and responsibility with God. And there's a development of Satan. I guess the best book I've ever read on that is Old Testament Theology by A.B. Clark, which shows in the Old Testament Satan is a servant of God, the book of Job, chapter 1, verse 1. But by the New Testament time, he becomes a arch-fiend enemy. Okay? Let's look at this. Take up a lament over the king of Tyre. It's a dirge, funeral song. Thus says the Lord God. Now, here is a series beginning in 12 and going down through 15, why I think it can't refer simply to a man. Let me give them to you quickly. Number 1, he is the seal or pattern of perfection. Number 2, he is full of wisdom and beauty. Number 3, he was in the Garden of Eden. Number 4, he is clothed with colored gems. Number 5, he is the musical leader and the personification of music. Number 6, he is the anointed cherub that covers. Number 7, he was in God's presence. And number 8, he is blameless. Now that can't refer to the king of Tyre. It amazes me as I went through this, the number of commentaries that don't mention Satan at all in connection with this chapter. The pulpit commentary, the Broadman commentary, Blackwood, the famous preacher's commentary, Tyndale's Old Testament Ezekiel doesn't mention it. The first ones to really draw a connection here was Origen and Tertullian, and of course those are New Testament, post-New Testament preachers. So it hasn't always been seen here, but when you look at it in connection with Isaiah 14, you get something of the origin of evil. And that's always been a problem to us. It's obvious to me that evil began in the angelic world, and that men were affected by the fall in the angelic world. However much I don't understand that, that seems to be what we're talking about. Now, the seal of perfection in verse 12 means the pattern or emblem or measure of perfection. What a strong term. The rabbis got so caught up in this interpretation here that they made all of these apply to Adam that he lost in the rebellion against God. But in context, I don't think that'll fit. Notice it mentions here in Eden, the Garden of God, Genesis 2 and 3. The king of Tyre certainly wasn't in Eden. And then all these mentions of jewels in verse 13. This seems to describe the breastplate, the ephod of the high priest, a different jewel for every tribe. Now, the Masoretic text only lists 9 jewels, but the Septuagint lists all 12 jewels, and if you want to see that, it's in Exodus 28, 17 through 20. Okay? Now, the latter part of verse 13, my New American Standard has, and the gold, the workmanship of your settings and sockets. Now, literally, this means tambourines and flutes. So what we have here is the music, normally use these things for a harem. But here it is, and notice it says, it was in you. You might want to see the New Jerusalem Bible, or the Jerusalem Bible for a good translation here. He personified music. That's the idea. On the day that you were created, look at verse 15, the same idea of being created. That shows that the evil one is a created being. Everything is created but God. This is not Zoroastrian dualism, Ahura Mazda and Angra Mayenta. This is the Creator Yahweh, and everything else is created, including the host of heaven and the host of the earth. And so there's only one Creator. Now, notice it mentions here, you are anointed, you are. Now, some have, because they're nervous about the interpreter, this is Satan, they have, you provided, you were provided with. That's what Jerusalem Bible has, RSV has, Peshitta has, New English Bible has, but that's not true. American Standard Version, New American Standard Version, follow the Masoretic text better. You were the anointed cherub who covers. Now, what is a cherub? Well, they're described first in the Garden of Eden experience, Genesis 3:24, when man was excluded from the tree of life and was protected by the cherub with the sword that went both ways. It's mentioned again of the cherub over the mercy seat that faces the place of propitiation. You might want to see Exodus 25:8, Psalms 80 verse 1, Psalms 99:1, Isaiah 37:16. And then we have the chariot throne of God mentioned, 2 Samuel 22:12, Psalms 18:10, and Ezekiel 1, chapter 1 and 10 are the chariot throne of God. So, boy, this is a close, close angelic servant of God. And here he is called the anointed. That's the same word as Messiah. What a high, high angelic being. The anointed cherub who covers or guards close to God's throne. That's why we often call Satan an archangel. There's not many archangels mentioned in the Bible. Michael. But this is a strong, strong, strong term. The description of the archangels, of the cherubs found in Ezekiel 1 and 10 are very similar to the beast described in Revelation 4. Although in Revelation 4 there is some mixing of the cherubim and seraphim together. Notice it says, and you were on the holy mountain of God. Now this may be a different metaphor than Eden. This seems to refer to Sinai or something like that. You might want to see Isaiah 14:13 for that same idea. Notice it says, you walked in the midst of the stones of fire. This means the glittering gems, which seems to describe God's throne room in Revelation 4. The crystal sea kind of idea. So he was right close to God. Notice it says, you are blameless. This is the word unblemished, used of sacrificial animals, where no fault was found. This is the word used of Jesus in the New Testament Greek. By the abundance of your trade, verse 16. Well, obviously, verse 16 and verse 18 refer to the king of Tyre. But you see how the chapter is kind of interwoven between supernatural elements and natural elements? Well, friend, our world is one. Our world seems to us to have natural laws and to guide the nature. But in reality, this world is a supernatural, penetrated natural order. And we can't get around that. It is both, and that's what this is saying. Notice it mentions here, therefore I have cast you as profane from the mountain of God. Now that never happened to the king of Tyre. Seems to have happened to Satan. Your heart was lifted up because of your beauty. You corrupted your wisdom by reason of your splendor. I cast you to the ground. Wow, that seems to refer both to Satan and this proud world ruler as it does to Babylon in Isaiah chapter 14. Now the rest of this chapter, beginning in verse 20, picks up on Sidon. You notice the modern map, Tyre and Sidon are both coastal cities. They were Phoenician cities. The Phoenicians are related to the Philistines. They both possibly came from the island of Crete. The Phoenicians came earlier, the Philistines around 1200 B.C. They tried to invade Egypt and couldn't and settled on the southern Palestinian coast. But anyway, this is a judgment on them because of the pride of their arrogance, because of their animosity against Israel and God's people, and God's just going to judge both of these cities, which represent the whole nation. Now, in verse 25 and 26, we have a tremendous ray of hope. And I want to tell you, it was well needed in this time in Ezekiel. We have the hope of the people of God being restored to the covenant relationship and being restored to the promised land. Okay? And in verse 26, we have the same emphasis that Israel was a witness to the nations. She was meant to be a kingdom of priests. When she failed as that, she was a witness in a negative sense that God judged her and took her into captivity. I think God still uses Israel as a witness. You might well see Romans 9 through 11. What we have here is the idea that God's promises are sure. And He made some promises to Israel, and He's going to keep them because of His namesake. But every promise of God is conditional man's response. When the Jewish nation did not become a kingdom of priests to win all the world, God judged them, and many of the parables of Jesus, like the wicked husbandman, is a judgment either on the leaders of Judaism of the first century or on Judaism itself. And so now God's used the church. Now we got to remember, as Israel was chosen as a kingdom of priests, God has chosen us as witnesses and ministers. The church is meant to be a kingdom of priests. For God's goal has always been the redemption of all men. He chose Abraham to choose a nation to choose all men. Then He chose, and we were all chosen in Jesus Christ. And the individual call came to us that as we unite collectively in the church, we would reach out into all the world. God's heart has always gone out to fallen man. Aren't you glad that's the kind of God we have? A God who is seeking us and active. Now, friends, I want to tell you, in our world, with a loving God seeking us, there is a supernatural force that is powerful, logical, beautiful. Satan's no little guy with red horns and a tail. We've done that to kind of push him off the stage in ridiculousness. Friends, he is a powerful angel of light. He came to Jesus quoting scriptures. He'll take a little thing and twist it. He'll take good and make it bad. He'll try to do everything to thwart God's will in God's world and in God's people. And we got to know that. The spiritual battle of Ephesians chapter 6, verses 10 and following, is a reality. It's in the area of government. It's in the area of families. And the primary stroke is human pride, the cause of the fall of man, the fall of Satan. Well, I've enjoyed being with you, and I'll see you again, same time, same place, next week. God bless you.